Welcome to Interleaved, where we take a deep dive into topics from the Daf Yomi with modern-day sages of the Torah and the world. I'm Natanael Zelos Pillay. On today's episode, The Other Rabbi.
Someone once said to me, we had one heretic and you took him away from us. Well, to a certain extent, that's the case.
Every culture has its outcasts, its persona non grata, its bogeymen. For the rabbis of the Talmud, that person was Elisha ben Abuya, or, as he was known to them, Acher, the other one. We know that Elisha was a brilliant scholar, mystic, and teacher of Rabbi Meir, one of the most important sages of the Tannaitic period. We know very little else about him. Yet over nearly two millennia of Jewish life, Elisha has become a scapegoat for Jewish heresy of all kinds, his story the origin story of Jewish heretics across time and place. Much of this is because of how the rabbis tell his story in Tractate Chagiga. What is the story, and why did the rabbis tell it in this way? Today, we have the pleasure of speaking with someone who wrote half of an entire book on these very questions, Rabbi Dr. Alon Goshen Gottstein. Rabbi Dr. Alon Goshen Gottstein is the founder and director of the Elijah Interfaith Institute, a nonprofit, international, UNESCO-sponsored interfaith organization. A noted scholar of Jewish studies, he has held academic posts at Tel Aviv University and has served as director of the Center for the Study of Rabbinic Thought, Beit Moreshah College, Jerusalem. Rabbi Dr. Goshen Gottstein is the author or editor of many books, including The Jewish Encounter with Hinduism, Jewish Theology and World Religions, and most recently, Interreligious Heroes, Role Models and Spiritual Exemplars for Interfaith Practice. His book, The Sinner and the Amnesiac, The Rabbinic Invention of Elisha ben Abuya and Eleazar ben Arach, was published in 2000 by Stanford University Press. Alon, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Netanel. Thank you for digging me out and digging this book out from the previous millennium.
I'm very excited to get into it. So before we jump in, what drew you to the character of Elisha ben Abuya, and what moved you to write a book about him?
The answer is nothing. People have different ways of working. Things just happen where I'm concerned. I don't intend them to happen, they happen. So most of my books just happened. In retrospect, I can see design behind many of the things I've done. And now increasingly I'm working through design. But this book on Elisha ben Abuya, it happened. In other words, I had been studying. I think I'd been teaching. I don't remember anymore. I got into the Tannaitic sources, Chagiga. Then I started to see things. I do see things as I study. And one thing led to the other. And the book just happened. So the answer is nothing drew me to it. In fact, I have my firstborn son is named Elisha. And people were asking, you know, if I named it after Elisha ben Abuya. And the answer is no. He's never been a particular hero of mine. I don't consider him to be a hero in the first place. I consider him to be a mistake of the history of Jewish tradition of interpretation. And therefore, there's nothing in the figure himself that draws me. I mean, many people are drawn to him because he's the heretic. He's the other. He's the driven leaf, whatever it is. No, I don't come there. I just accidentally stumbled upon readings of texts and the book emerged.
Thank you. I appreciate your candor on that. So you mentioned that you believe Elisha ben Abuya was a mistake in a way. Could you elaborate a little more on that? And does that get to the central thesis of your book, perhaps?
That's the core of the thesis of my book. So if you want me to spell that out now, I'm happy to jump right into it.
Let's dive into the Daf. We're first introduced to the character of Elisha ben Abuya, or Acher, as he is known to the sages, in a strange and cryptic Baraita on 14b, which describes four sages entering the Pardes, literally an orchard, but understood to mean the mystical secrets of Torah. The four sages who entered the Pardes were the famous Rabbi Akiva, Elisha ben Abuya, ben Azai, and ben Zoma. The Baraita goes on to describe what happened to each of the sages. Ben Azai glimpsed the divine presence and died. Ben Zoma glimpsed and lost his mind. Rabbi Akiva came out safely, and Elisha ben Abuya chopped down the shoots of saplings.
So look, the important thing to bear in mind is a fundamental distinction between Elisha and Tannaitic and Amoraic sources. So when you look at the image of Elisha ben Abuya, there's nothing in earlier sources, Tannaitic sources, to suggest anything problematic in this hero. In fact, in chapter 4 of Avot, he's listed among all the other sages giving his particular teaching that has to do with Torah study. And similarly, in Avot Rabbi Natan, there's both versions, there are collections of sayings that are completely typical. One asks, how is it that tradition maintained the memory of this person who was such a great sinner? Of course, people who subscribe to the notion so we say the historical reading of his great sinnerhood, we'll say, well, this all happened before he sinned. Well, let's even assume that is the case, that all these sayings were said before he sinned. Why were they preserved? Not all the sages of the Mishnah and Talmud are preserved in Avot. There's something selective about it. There's something honorific about it. The proof for that is Shmuel HaKatan, whose saying is simply a citation from a pasuk, a verse in Mishlei, "Binfolo yivcha al tismach," don't rejoice when your enemy falls. So if the whole idea is to give a teaching, why should a sage be cited simply by reciting a biblical verse? But if the point is that inclusion in Avot is an honorific, then it makes sense. Then you want to include certain people, and Avot has to be studied not only for its content, but also for the list of sages it does, and potentially doesn't include. Seen from this perspective, surely the editors of Avot would have been familiar with his sinfulness had it been a historical reality, in which case, why did they preserve his memory? And this point is consistent across Tanaitic literature, with one major exception that I'm going to go into in just a second. Whereas in Amoraic literature, he's consistently a sinner. So how does one account for this distinction between what we find in Tanaitic and in Amoraic literature? And here, when I refer to an accident of interpretation, it has to do with the one passage that is enigmatic. And this is the story of the four who entered Pardes. And when you ask how I got to Elisha through an analysis of Arba Nichnasu LePardes. And having gotten into it, initially, I think in the 1994, I think, article in Harvard Theological Review, things then expanded and went on from there, and then the whole picture emerged. So what I discovered is that basically there is a text whose meaning is not clear. There is a tradition that casts him as a sinner. As a consequence of that, later tradition has to make sense of that earlier tradition. And then everything that you find in Amoraic tradition is an offshoot either of the direct interpretation of the Tanaitic passage, which appears in Tosefta Chagiga of Arba Nichnasu LePardes, or traditions that seek to account for how can it be that a sage sinned, and then they have to make up the story and offer interpretations of how it is that a sage could come and sin. But were it not for the existence of this particular passage of Arba Nichnasu LePardes, the entire memory of Elisha would have never evolved as a sinner. And once you decide that he's a sinner, then the gates of sinhood remain open and one can project upon him whatever one wants to. Now, the question is, what are the mechanisms of projection? So one mechanism of projection is that really they project on him what they consider to be archetypal. And therefore, if you imagine a sinner, this is what a sinner would look like. The other method or the other type of projection is exegetically based. You have a key text, you have enigmatic elements in it, and then you weave the story around the enigmatic elements in the key text that you are interpreting. So between those two factors, the image of Elisha the sinner emerges. I haven't yet demonstrated the process, but I'm giving sort of a 30 or 20,000 feet view of it.
Thank you so much for laying that out. That's really, really helpful. I do have a question from this bird's eye view. This is speaking about this passage in Chagiga, which follows the story of Arba Nichnasu LePardes. Is any part of this, you know, extended passage, does it have any basis in any sort of pre-Amoraic literature? Or is it entirely Amoraic exegesis?
It's all derivative of Tosefta Chagiga.
Oh, okay. Got it.
In other words, Tosefta Chagiga has the key elements, and then from there, everything unfolds. The truth is that the passage about Elisha ben Abuya in Chagiga can't be really appreciated out of context, because the Arba Nichnasu LePardes has to be seen in the framework of the entire section of, actually end of first chapter and then most of second chapter of Tosefta Chagiga. One of my colleagues, David Halpern, called this the mystical collection. So he saw that as a unit, and I also see it as a unit. And this essay, this article that I referred to earlier in Harvard Theological Review, basically offers a close reading of this so-called mystical collection. And there's a particular message that emerges from it. On the level of Tosefta Chagiga, the message of the passage is, you have to be grounded in teacher-disciple relations when dealing with these areas of Ma'aseh Bereshit and Ma'aseh Merkava. In other words, with either commentary or mystical reflection meditation on the subject of the Merkava, this description of the divine chariot as found in the first chapter of Ezekiel. It's not clear that Maaseh Bereshit, the Mishnah Chagiga speaks of three categories, Maaseh Merkava, Maaseh Bereshit, and Arayot. While some later authorities seek to understand Arayot also along the lines of something mystical, most of the tradition, including the Gemara, does not see it that way. And one can debate whether Maaseh Bereshit really is mystical or not. In another essay that I had written on the subject, I argue that it is not to do with mystical speculation. Rather, Maaseh Bereshit has to do with looking at the origins of the world. In a nutshell, I realize our subject right now is Aharon HaSukkah, but as we're talking about Chagiga as part of that larger corpus. So Maaseh Bereshit basically has to do with looking at something that's not fitting of divine dignity. The notion that we entertain nowadays of creation ex nihilo, in other words, God created the world from nothing, is not the notion that the rabbis held. The rabbis followed the plain sense of the Bible, of the Torah, where the world was created from primordial matter, and that primordial matter was water and chaotic. And God is building the world out of dung, out of garbage. So looking at Maaseh Bereshit is looking at the problematic, unsavory elements, potentially colored also in terms of negative morality or the forces of evil. And they are reconfigured and reconstructed into the world by God in the act of creation. So it's a matter of divine dignity not to meditate and not to exegete those particular verses, because the world was initially mayim b'mayim. It was chaos of the water symbolizing the chaotic powers as we find them in ancient traditions, Babylon and elsewhere. That's not the same as speculation on the divine glory as you find in Yechezkel. And therefore, I would even say that Maaseh Bereshit is not mystical. So the mystical element, which going back now to the point about the meaning of the mystical collection, is that engaging in Maaseh Merkava, and that's where the mystical collection comes in, has to be done under the supervision of a rabbi. Because otherwise, you're going to enter the psukim, the verses, on your own, and then you're going to get it caught up in imagination, and such imagination will lead you to free-form mystical speculation, which is going to take you into error. And that free-form mystical speculation is a form of fulfilling your desires, and your desire for mystical experience has to be controlled by teacher-disciple relations and by the hermeneutical process. So it's through the relationship with the teacher that your speculation on the Merkava has to be carried out. And within that larger message appears the passage of four entered Pardes. And within that, we have to understand how Elisha ben Abuya figures in. And he figures in as someone who delivers a message on this particular point of the nature of mystical reflection, guided, unguided, within tradition, independent.
Mm-hmm. So do you see kind of the story of Elisha ben Abuya as kind of a cautionary tale of what happens when the mystical tradition is not transmitted properly in this?
Okay, so now we've got to understand the passage of Rabbi Nachman Sula Pardes. So the passage of Rabbi Nachman Sula Pardes basically is not a passage, it's not a cautionary tale of Elisha, because the passage doesn't focus on him explicitly. Mm-hmm. The passage has four heroes. So Netanel, when is the last time that you encountered a list of four people? Four something, you know, a typology of four. And this will come to the mind of many of the listeners.
Pesach is coming up, so I'm thinking of the four sons.
Pesach is the archetypal example, right? Four sons, Chacham Rasha, so two polars, and then two in-betweens, Tam v'Sheino Yodeh Lishol. If you look at Avot, at the fifth chapter, the chapter is organized according to numerical lists. Similarly, the numerical lists follow this pattern of the two extremes and what is in between. If you recognize that, then you recognize that this was structured along the lines of the archetypal lists that are organized around the number four, in other cases in Chazal. It's further compounded by other sources that play into the image of these particular heroes. Actually, what I demonstrate in the book is that the fate that each of these sages met is a reversal of teachings of theirs. The most obvious case is Ben Azai. Ben Azai says, Yakar b'nei Hashem amavta l'chassidav. That's when tzaddikim see God before they pass away. And concerning him, it says, Hitzitz v'met. Each of the four, there's an attempt to correlate his teachings with the fate he met with. These names did not exist independently. We have a tradition that appears in Avodah Rabbi Natan. It's also echoed in the Babli. You can see three Chachamim and three Talmidei Chachamim, three sages and three disciples. One of the sages is Rabbi Akiva. The three disciples are the three people that are here. So they exist in an earlier text as disciples. Rabbi Akiva, who actually Nichnas b'shalom, yetzah b'shalom, entered and exited the Pardes safely, is the teacher. So here they're cast as the teacher has the successful ability to enter the speculation of Maaseh Merkavah, whereas the three Talmidim, because they don't follow the guidance, are not able to see through. So even the choice of these individuals is not historically based, but owes to earlier lists, and therefore becomes a kind of playing and reconfiguring of rabbinic materials. Within that reconfiguration, you take texts of what they said earlier, and you reverse their meaning, thereby indicating their failure to live up to their own teaching. Why? Well, if you have a teaching and you don't follow the guidance of the teacher, then you end up with an outcome that undermines your own teaching. So the teaching on Elisha ben Abuya and Kitzetz bin Etiot is a reversal of teachings of his that we find in Avodah Rabbi Natan, where these terms appear. In other words, Elisha ben Abuya talks about how to learn Torah, and he says, watch out that you maintain certain procedures, because if not, the gader, the fence, the hedge will fall and will uproot the plants. So the author of the Tosefta basically takes an earlier saying of his, inverts its meaning, and thereby shows, well, this Talmid wasn't faithful to the teacher, and therefore his earlier teachings are not upheld. So it's all a play on sources upon sources, from which, in the context of good, bad, and two in between, you cast as Rabbi Akiva is the good, Elisha ben Abuya is the bad, Benaza and Benzoma are the in-between positions, and the bad basically is someone who totally inverts the meaning of his teachings. And it sounds very ominous what it means, kitzetz bin etiot. But the fact is, I don't even know that the Tosefta had an intention of what mikatzetz bin etiot was. If it did, maybe it was not fulfilling the mitzvot. I don't know. I mean, there are traditions where kitzetz bin etiot appears that way. There isn't a definite necessary meaning of what kitzetz bin etiot was, to the extent that this really is a very playful unit that plays with the materials and seeks to deliver a message. It's anything but a historical report. Because the term katzetz bin etiot emerged from this process of internal interpretation within the tradition, that raised the question, well, what does this really mean? So when you read something out of context, and when you read something out of genre, the meaning radically changes. So the meaning of the tradition that could and should have been simple and straightforward, or rather understood on its own terms, simply as this opposition of the good and the bad, started to become a challenge because it was read not as a typological list, but as a historical report. Once it's read as a historical report, you've got to know, well, what did he do? Well, that requires understanding what it means, mekatzetz bin etiot, or seizing onto any element you can to make sense of what went wrong with Elisha ben Abuya. This is how the whole story with Elisha ben Abuya unfolded. Someone once said to me, we had one heretic and you took him away from us. Well, to a certain extent, that's the case. So we had one heretic, but we didn't really have him. He was an accident of interpretation, and he remains an accident of interpretation, because what happens is everyone continues to project himself upon him down to this very day, where people continue to have their own Elishas. All the people who struggle with tradition and have a hard time with it, and there's a very rich tradition, especially from the 19th century onwards, of people in the same way that the rabbis projected onto Elisha their own concerns of understanding how a sage can sin. So 19th and 20th century orthodox projected onto Elisha the meaning and the value, and for them, the positive value of having a sinning or heretic sage who was cast as a heretic and as a Christian, as a Zoroastrian, as a Gnostic, and who knows what. It shows the beauty of interpretation. It also shows the problem of the history of interpretation when it's undertaken as history.
Wow, that was really enlightening. I feel like I have a whole fresh reading on this text now. Just while we're at it, and I know this could digress really far, but do you see any kind of allusion within the next line in that Tosefta about, you know, getting to the tiles of marble? Don't say water, water.
No, it's an expansion of the Babli. Uh-huh. It's part of an attempt of the Babli to make sense of the whole story. And that's probably taken from a later literature that took the story literally and then projected upon it its own possibly mystical experience. In other words, this was already a recasting from probably from the Hechalot literature into the Babli, because by that point there was already a tradition that had elaborated things on the, shall we say, mystical side or esoteric side. So here we have a point of crossover or possible crossover. And even if it isn't an impact of the Hechalot tradition, because scholars debate, you know, who influenced whom at this point, it still has to do with a later interpretation of how to make sense of this. But that already has to do with a clear sense of mistaken gazing and what did they see wrong and what did they say. And note that in this tradition, the Altamul Maimayim really goes back to the deeper logic of the Tosefta, because the Tosefta has to do with teachers and disciples. In the typological list, you don't know that Rabbi Akiva has more status than others. He's not their teacher. There's four. He was successful. The other ones were the failures. It's true, as I said, that his name was integrated because he existed in an earlier tradition of teachers where they were in an earlier list of disciples. But the Tosefta flattens that difference out and presents all four on the par. The Bavli reconfigures it in such a way that Rabbi Akiva is the teacher and they're the disciples, and he's giving them the warnings and they're not able to live up to them. So you see how the Bavli, consciously or unconsciously, ends up justifying the assumptions of the relationship of teacher and disciple, but not on hermeneutical grounds, but on the power of seeing correctly, not being deceived by what you see. But the answer is it's not in the Tosefta, and therefore that's precisely the point. It shows how the Tosefta did not include this kind of mystical gazing, because it really was within the frame of a literary unit that was delivering a message rather than a description of something that transpired.
So on 15a, we are told the reason why Elisha ben Avuya became a heretic. The Talmud says that it happened because he saw the archangel Metatron, or Metatron, sitting and writing the merits of the Jewish people, even though there is an unwritten rule in heaven that no one except God can sit down. Because of this, Elisha wondered if there was another power in the world besides God. I have so many questions on this, so I guess I'll just let you talk about it.
So this whole passage has to be understood exegetically. If you ask yourself, how did this story arise? It arose as a point-by-point commentary in the Tosefta. So each of the four sages has a verse attached to him. The verse attached to Elisha is a verse from Kohelet. Al titenet picha lachti et besarecha. Can you give us the exact reference on that? Because I'm speaking from memory.
Sure. Kohelet 5:5. Hey.
Al titenet picha lachti et besarecha. So, in context, I think what the author of the so-called mystical collection wanted to do was to show someone who is full of desire. He can't wait for the fruit to be ripe and eats it unripe. So he kitzetz bintio, in other words, he plucks the fruit before the fruit is ready. And don't let your mouth cause your body sin. In other words, don't let your desire for taking something prematurely bring about an upset stomach. But of course, if you don't understand that this is basically an illustration of someone who did the wrong thing by force of desire, and desire certainly is an element of the mystical collection. In other words, the sages engage in activity that's driven by desire rather than being driven by the canons of protection and safety the teacher-disciple relations provide. So if you don't understand what that is, then you start to understand, what does it mean? Your mouth caused your flesh to sin? Now, I think this is all that the Tosefta wanted, but in Kohelet continues, don't say before the angel that it is Eshgaga, an error. Why should God be angry at your voice or at your speech, that would mean, and destroy your handiwork? Now, you can't understand the evolution of the text of the Babli if you don't recognize the fact that the Babli is commenting here on the second part of the verse that the Tosefta didn't bring. So, Al titenet picha lachti et besarecha. In the Tosefta, what was the mouth doing? There are two functions of the mouth, right? Eating and speaking. So what the Babli does, he takes the passage whose original meaning had to do with eating and turns it into speaking. Now, that's not so outrageous considering the fact that the continuation of the verse is Alto Malik Ne'alah, don't say something before the angel. But if you're only reading the first part, then the sin of the mouth is eating. If you're reading the verse in its entirety, then the sin of the mouth is speaking. So then you have to come up with a story. Look at the Babli's challenge. You have to come up with a story that talks about Kitzutz Benetiot, which based on other texts will be sinning. Okay? So we assume that. How do you bridge a story of a sage who engaged in mystical speculation and he became a sinner? Right? Worst comes to worst, he had a bad experience. He had a bad trip on Merkava LSD. How do you emerge from a, as Rav Haigelon says, a heavenly ascent as a sinner? So it has to cast an entire story to account for a sinning sage. The Tosefta didn't have that problem because it didn't have a sinning sage. All it had was an archetype, a literary archetype. But once it's taken factually, in other words, the hard thing about my thesis is basically I argue that the Rebbe of the Babli didn't understand the Tosefta or cast it in a different light, already read it historically, saying this should have been read differently. So this introduces a serious tension between texts in their Tanaitic and texts in their Amoraic meaning and how the practices of interpretation of the Babli operate. So we know that this is what's on the table here. So the Babli then has to account for how a sage who has a heavenly ascent emerges as a sinner with the use of these elements from the Pasuk. So he has some speech. They said something before an angel. Well, Hamalach is Metatron, because Metatron is, most angels have what are called theophoric names, names that refer to God at the end, right? Michael, Gabriel, Raphael, etc. Metatron actually has a whole other name. It comes from something to do with the divine throne. Maybe for this reason, he's more relevant to Merkava speculations, in as much as Merkava has to do with the divine chariot or the divine seat. So his seat is next to God's seat, is one possible etymology. So he, but in some rabbinic texts and the mystical texts of the group called Heichalot, whose date ranges either from the rabbinic, early rabbinic, this rabbinic period all the way to the 8th century or so. So in those texts, he is the angel by default. So you say something and something happens to him. And as a consequence of that, you sin. And God is angry with you and destroys your handiwork. In other words, destroys something that's valuable to you of what you've done. Now, if you have to account for a sinning sage. So now look what the Babli does. Elisha ben Abuya is on a heavenly ascent and he sees something related to the Malach Metatron and he mistakes its meaning. He doesn't realize what it really means, as a consequence of which he says or blurts out something wrong. What does he blurt out? Well, there was a basically angels don't sit, but God loves Israel so much that once a day he allows the divine scribe, who's here, Metatron, to sit down as a sign of honor and to write down Israel's merits. Elisha ben Abuya happened to just go up at that point, seeing him, not realizing the context, not knowing that there was an exception in heaven to the rule that angels don't sit. In other words, God loves Israel so much that he bends the rules. And he says, how could it be that there are two powers in heaven? After all, two divine entities are sitting here. So he has to be taught that there are no entities and that he mistook it. Potentially, there could have been other ways of teaching him that, but you've got to get to a point of how he emerged from there, a sinful sage. So they demonstrate the point by showing him that, no, he's just a servant. Therefore, he gets 60 fiery lashes. In other words, don't even think this is God. This is a servant who was given permission. Here he gets 60 fiery lashes. And this history to this theme of fiery lashes. So Metatron goes out, he's punished. Now Elisha's in real trouble. His saying what he said got an angel into trouble. Now he's got, this is bad karma, right? So now there has to be some payment for that. So the payment is that basically all his merit is wiped away. So he went up there with lots of merit and suddenly he did something wrong. He got punished. He lost all his merit. This is v'chibelet ma'aseh yadecha. God destroys your handiwork, in other words, he takes away all your merit. Okay, now he is without merit, and therefore he thinks that's it. It's all gone. And the heavenly voice says, all of you repent except for Elisha, because that's part of the of his handiwork. So Elisha emerges as someone who went up, mistook something in heaven, and emerged without any hope and with a sense of exclusion. Now, I forgot to say one thing, which is crucial to this understanding of this whole thing. Not only is there an element of a misunderstanding of the nature of this text, there's also an orthographic issue here. We have in several places, apropos, for instance, even Shmaisel Adonai Elohim Adonai Echad, there's a passage where Rabbi Meir is told, be careful as a scribe, one small change, you need to turn Echad to Acher, right? The difference between Echad and Acher is very minimal. It's just that little tag, that little, just that drop of ink on the right of the Dalet. So easily an Echad can become an Acher. Now, the structure of the Tosefta is Echad, 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 right? In the same way, you have Echad Chacham, Echad Rasha, Echad Tam, Echad Shani Adir Shalom. Also, Arba Nichnasu Lepardes. Echad Hitzitz V'met, Echad Hitzitz V'nivga, Echad Hitzitz V'kitzet V'nityot, Echad Nichnas B'Shalom Yatsa B'Shalom. Once it's decided that he's an Echad, all you need to do is to play with that Echad and to turn it into an Acher. So even the name Acher that was given to him is part of the play of the tradition. Once its meaning isn't clear, because the earliest manuscripts in Tosefta call him Echad, but then later, or other manuscripts in Tosefta call him Acher, which is a later evolution of the tradition based on the fact that the typological nature of this literary unit is no longer understood. So if he's the bad guy, then it's very easy to turn the Echad into Acher. And here we have the name Acher. Well, the Bible already knows the name Acher, so he has to account for how can he have been an Acher? He became an Acher because all of Israel are invited to repent except for him. So this except for him already plays out the meaning of the Acher. So the Chibelet Maaseh Yadech, his handiwork is destroyed. He loses his merits. He becomes an Acher. And in becoming an Acher, he then becomes the sinner who has nothing to lose. And therefore he says, let me go and enjoy the world because the gates of heaven are shut even to my repentance. So all this emerges from the history of interpretation of the text, where the earlier Tanaitic sources would not sustain this reading. And the later sources, through a series of changes and plays of an enigmatic text, including the evolution of Echad to Acher, give this new meaning and thereby cast a new personality. And then the speculation on Elisha ben Abuya as an Acher, of course, opens up the gate of interpretation, imagination, projection, and identification, where everyone imagines this Acher, what could be so Acher about him. In my own personal biography, it's an interesting thing because one of the books that I edited is called The Religious Other. And this, I mean, I made a largely a career shift from being a scholar of rabbinics to being a scholar of theology of religions. In other words, how Judaism reflects on other religions and interfaith relations. So within that context, one of the first big projects I did was a project called The Religious Other. So funnily enough, I moved from the study of Elisha ben Abuya as the other to the religious other, and people pointed that out. Again, not intentional. One of these things you only see in hindsight.
The narrative arc of Elisha ben Abuya concludes on 15b, where Rabbi Meir attempts to rehabilitate his former teacher's reputation and get him into the world to come following his death. While the heavenly court declares that Elisha must remain in a state of limbo because he cannot be judged for his sins, since the merit of Torah protected him, and simultaneously cannot enter the world to come because of his sins, Rabbi Meir argues that he be judged in hell like everyone else, so he can eventually enter the world to come. Two stories that follow, about the Amora Rabbi Yochanan and the redactor of the Mishnah Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, confirm that Rabbi Meir's efforts were successful. But the Talmud does not stop there. It continues to question why Rabbi Meir was allowed to learn Torah from Elisha, despite the general principle that Torah must only be learned from rabbis who are similar in their deeds to angels. Various answers are given. Rabbi Meir knew how to find the kernel and throw away the husk. Torah can be learned from anyone as long as it seems to align with the divine will. And finally, that whatever a Torah scholar does in his own life cannot soil the Torah he teaches. And yet, as I said earlier, Elisha's Torah does not appear elsewhere in the entire Talmud, other than those three places. What does this apparent contradiction say to you about Elisha's legacy in rabbinic literature? And what contemporary lessons might we glean from the rabbi's tendentious interpretation of his character?
So basically what happens is that once the rabbis are confronted with a sinning sage, there's a sense of loyalty within the guild, which may in its own way also betray potential understanding or recognition of the fact that he really wasn't a sinner, so they have to rehabilitate his name. But in all likelihood, that's not the case. In all likelihood, they really assumed there was a sinner sage. And sinner sage constitutes a very interesting test case, because ideally rabbis should match their teaching, their Torah, to their action. And here we have someone who has that gap between teaching and action. So that becomes a test case for the value of Torah, not as what leads to action, but Torah in and of itself. So Elisha then becomes the test case or the symbol for the value of Torah over and against proper behavior. In other words, in the case of the sinning sage, what has more power, the Torah or the actions? And the entire story with Elisha and Rabbi Meir and his different ways of rectifying him are basically attempts consciously to affirm the value of Torah as more powerful than mistaken deeds. And maybe subconsciously, since you're studying psychology, maybe subconsciously to really correct what they've done to him and to reclaim him, and to show that, well, at the end of the day, everyone is saved.
Any final thoughts about that, I guess, theme, perhaps given modern rabbinic authority? And
the thing is, the rabbis don't whitewash him. Rabbis don't whitewash Acher.
Right.
They claim he's a sinner, and yet the Torah saves him. The problem with these instances that we're seeing in these last few years is that people refuse to recognize the power of sin, so they whitewash people. Right. So if there's any lesson that emerges from Elisha ben Abuya, is if you want to save someone, don't whitewash them first.
Mm.
That's great. I've never seen that before. Thank you for asking that question. That's my takeaway from today's conversation.
Well, I'm largely speechless here. That's just, wow. Rabbi Dr. Alon Goshen Gottstein, thank you so much.
My pleasure. It was a wonderful conversation, Netanel.
Between episodes, you can keep up with Interleaved on Facebook and Twitter. If you like what you heard, follow us, leave us a review, and share this with your friends. Special thanks to our executive producer, Adina Karp. Come back next time for another deep dive.